Whether or not we want to admit it, death is an inevitable outcome of life. It just is. We will all experience the process ourselves, and we're likely to have loved ones go through it too. For many people, confronting the fact that their lives will eventually end and that those they love will go too can cause a lot of fear, anxiety, and sadness. But our next guests write in a new book that accepting that you or a loved one is going to die does not have to be a scary experience. In fact, they write that with honest and careful planning, the process can be beautiful and healing. BJ Miller is a doctor who specializes in palliative and end-of-life care. BJ, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Shoshana Berger is the global editorial director for IDEO. They co-authored the book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. Shoshana, thank you for coming on, too.
Happy to be here.
BJ, let's start with you. The first line of the book is, there is nothing wrong with you for dying. Why did you want to start the book on that foot?
Well, as you pointed out in your introduction, this subject is, you know, universal, but we somehow find all sorts of ways to keep it in a closet. And that has an effect of sort of putting a lot of shame around the issue, especially because medicine has so much to say on the subject, and medicine, left to its own devices, tends to pathologize nature on some level. And so it seemed really important to, right out of the chutes, make sure the readers understand that this is, you're not doing something wrong for dying. You're not failing. This is not pathological. This is normal.
I do think that at certain stages in life, perhaps the teen years, maybe a little older, we feel like we are immortal and invincible. And it does come as something of a shock, whatever I think the experience or the realization is that, wow, we are not going to be here all the time, and life is going to go on without us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's for sure, and there's a lot of hard realizations in that, but the sooner you kind of grok that reality, the sooner you get to the far side of that. And the far side of it is, well, gosh, okay, so time is precious. So it matters what I do. It matters what I choose to do and choose not to do. It matters where I spend my time. Death is the thing that makes life precious. And that's a happy realization. So yeah, it pays to think about these things earlier so you can get to that far side versus the norm, which is keep the subject at bay until it's too late. And then you've got a pile of regrets on top of the pain.
BJ, is there language that is used in medical settings that don't really help people think of death as a natural part of life?
Oh, absolutely. Our language is just really deplorable on the subject. It's not just in medicine. I think in all around, we use sort of warring language. We go to war with cancer. And then, of course, there's the inevitable, well, he lost his battle to cancer. And so not only do you have to die and deal with the sorrow that goes with that, but then you have to feel like a loser. That's on all of us. We keep perpetuating this language. Medicine takes it even a step further and pathologizes it. But we even say crazy things like she failed treatment when, of course, it's the opposite. If there's any failure, the treatment failed her. But we don't say that. So we send all sorts of signals to people that make them feel way worse than they need to.
Shoshana, this book is quite unique, I think, because while it does take a philosophical tone at times, it's actually really a manual at the heart of it. Why did you want to put the book together in that way, where it gave people very concrete ways to deal with the end of life?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think it's a really important distinction. There's a lot of books out there that deal with this on a more philosophical level, and those are lovely. But for me, you know, as a caregiver to my father, as he dealt with a difficult death and an incurable illness, I felt like I had absolutely no clue how to navigate. I didn't know how to deal with his doctors or insurance or what care we could get. Even dealing with family dysfunction was an issue for us. And so I was left in a spot where literally when my father died, my sister and I sat down at the computer and Googled, what do you do when someone dies? We didn't even know how to call the funeral home. So we felt like there was a real service in giving people almost a what to expect when you're expecting for the other half of life, a really brass tacks how-to guide that, you know, lovingly walks people through the whole process of this phase of life.
I love that you compared it to what to expect when you're expecting, because that is ushering a new life in, and I think it would be a rare situation where people are like, oh, you know, I'll just wing it. You know, I don't need to learn anything. But yet you're right. We don't think in the same way about ushering ourselves or someone else out of life.
Well, exactly. I mean, you would, you know, something like 90% of pregnant women read that book. It's a Bible. You would never go into that process without some guidance. And it's a massive life event. And death is too. It's one of our key life cycle events, and it's one of the things that's universal and unites us. And yet there's less honor and dignity conferred upon that time of life. And so we wanted to bring that back into the limelight and say, look, this is a really important transition, and you should probably think about it and prepare for it.
We're talking with Dr. B.J. Miller and writer Shoshana Berger about their new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And B.J., what kind of conversations should people have with their loved ones about their end-of-life plans? Because even if they have a clear idea of how they want things to go, it is often not enough if other people don't know it.
Well, you got it. I mean, these conversations, you need to say these things out loud. You need to talk with others. This is dying is something of a team sport. And it's also true that many of us are very alone in this world, and we may not have family, but all the more important that we communicate with our clinicians, our doctors, or our home health team, or our hospice team, etc. We are social beasts, and dying is a social event on a lot of levels. And to your point, there's all sorts of things that you need to kind of think through and wade through. But chief among them, I think the most important sort of takeaway is that you should name your healthcare proxy. Name the person who will speak for you if you are no longer able to speak for yourself. That single person, it can be a loved one or it can be a friend. It needs to be someone who can represent you faithfully and who will do well by not mixing their own emotions at the end of your life with what you might want. So sometimes it's not the closest person to you. In fact, that can be very hard for the spouse to be so objective. But that's probably, if we had to put our finger on a single thing, name that proxy and stay in touch with that person over time about your wishes, because most people's wishes change over time. And it's one thing when you're walking around the planet feeling well, you may have certain ideas of what you can and can't live with. But if you're deeper into illness and closer to the end of life, you may have a very different point of view on what you're willing to live with. So this is not a single conversation. This is a conversation you have over time.
And I think it's interesting because if you asked people, I think often they would think, well, I'm going to have a little time at the end to, you know, get things in order. But that doesn't always happen. Yes, there are many people who go through an illness of some length of time before passing away, but a lot of people don't. And so, Shoshana, the book recommends having a When I Die folder. I'm guessing you would recommend that be done sooner rather than later. What would be in it?
So there's about 20 things that go into that When I Die file, and I'm not going to go through them all, but I think the most important ones are you want that advance directive that BJ was just talking about so that you have someone to speak for you. If you, you know, walk out the door and get hit by a bus and you can't speak for yourself, you sure want someone who you trust to be at the bedside to be able to speak for you. So that should be signed and in there. And then, of course, we move through life now online and have a million different passwords. We have phones and computers that are password protected. How are your loved ones going to figure out what accounts to shut down, what subscriptions you have open, where you're banking? All of that information is protected. So you need to put all of those logins and passwords in that file. And then I'll just say that there's a sort of softer thing that you might think about putting in that file, which is, what am I going to leave behind that my loved ones are going to carry forward? Maybe that's a favorite recipe that you always cooked at Thanksgiving, or a piece of art that you created, or a family heritage piece that you want people to know about, that maybe a story about the family, or a letter to someone. There's so many beautiful things that you can leave for someone, and that just ends up becoming a real gift when they're grieving the loss of you.
We're talking with Dr. B.J. Miller and writer Shoshana Berger right now about their new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How are you approaching the end of your own life? How do you think we handle death in the U.S.? And what questions do you have about having conversations about death with your loved ones? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we continue our conversation about addressing the end of life without fear and anxiety. And we're talking to palliative care doctor B.J. Miller and writer Shoshana Berger right now about their new book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about preparing for the end of your own life or that of a loved one? Have you had these conversations with your friends or family? How did they go? And if you're a caregiver, what has your experience been like? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. And Shoshana, I wanted to ask you about one of the concepts in the book. Can you explain what an ethical will is for us?
Oh, sure. I'm glad you brought that up. So you pass down your value in a will. And what you pass down in an ethical will is your values. So what your family stories are, what you value as a person. And it's a very old tradition. It actually dates back 3,500 years to the Bible, when Jacob called his sons around him and admonished them for being bad people, and gave them some advice for how to be better people. But there's a modern practice that's kicking up around this to encourage people to think about not just the legacy you leave in terms of your stuff and how you hand that down, but how do you hand down your values and your stories from generation to generation? And there's actually someone not too far from you in the Twin Cities, Dr. Barry Baines, who has spearheaded this. He has a website called Celebrations of Life, and he helps people write these. And what he's found is that 3/4 of people who do it actually both feel better emotional and physical well-being after doing it, because it gives people an enormous sense of purpose and meaning, and that their life has meant something.
Let's go to the phone, and Rebecca in Monroe is up. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I lost my sister a couple of years ago, and I'm 6 years old, and she was 6 years older than me, and her health had been going steadily downhill. And when it finally happened, she was in hospice for a few days as she was dying, and her whole family, she has 4 kids, they were all around her and coming and going during that week. And she spent time with each person and was able to tell them a little bit, you know, what they meant to her, and allowed you to tell her what you meant, she meant to you. And at the very end, we all sang her song as she passed.
Wow, that is a very personal story to share with us, Rebecca. Thank you for that. And actually, that's, I want to go to Karen in Madison, because she helps people with that period of life. Karen, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm actually... I worked in hospice and also as a hospice volunteer for years, but have also had training as an end-of-life doula and do a lot of work as a death awareness educator with other people here in Madison. We host death cafes and do educational workshops and things for people to really, really go deep into their own core belief systems and, you know, to figure out where did they learn what they learned about end of life, and is that going to serve them well as they age or get ill and deal with dying and grief.
And we're running a little short on time. I want to let BJ and Shoshana comment on both these calls. It sounds to me, it sounds very positive. There are conversations going on and people are having what sound like very positive ways of passing.
Yeah, I amen. I think, Rebecca, thank you for sharing your story. I think I'm sure your sister's passing was not easy, but you guys created a lot of beauty around the moment, too. And I would imagine that affected your grief positively. I mean, it sounds like in some ways a beautiful memory. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but and I think you make the point that closure, you know, reconciliation, these are active. You have to do that. I don't think there's a natural closure, perhaps, except for death itself. But as human beings, we have to actively lean into this. We have to construct that kind of closure. And then I love the second point, too, about this naming the idea of a doula. I mean, Shoshana's and my partnership kind of proves this point too, which is dying is not simply a medical event. It's many, many things. It's a social, it's a spiritual event, etc. It accounts for everything. So there are other ways to approach this. You don't need a doctor in the mix necessarily. And death doulas is a relatively new enterprise that I think has great potential.
And we'll have to leave it there. BJ Miller and Shoshana Berger, thank you so much for joining us today. BJ Miller is a doctor who specializes in palliative and end-of-life care. Shoshana Berger is a writer, and they co-authored the book, A Beginner's Guide to the End, Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. The elementary school in Mattoon, Wisconsin, closed in 2016. Now a local nonprofit wants to buy the building, but a dispute about how it will be used has spiraled into a lawsuit over who has rights to the building itself. WPR's Rob Menser has the story.
Wade Reamer and Zach Keycaver visit the vacant Mattoon Elementary School often.
You don't hear the cars pulling up here, the people getting their kids. The kids running around, or the little kid riding his bike home from school. You know, the kids playing out here. Those sounds are gone. When those bells left.
The bells, yeah.
When that bell left for the class, everything else left too, you know. We can turn that around.
About 450 people live in Mattoon, and it's a close-knit community. People chat with neighbors in the grocery store. Next month, there's a village kickball tournament. Reamer is 56. He's lived in the area since he was 12. He sold his beef farm in 2017. He says he was out tapping maple trees when an idea hit him.
And all of a sudden, the light came on to me like, this Mattoon school, I mean, great place to do some mission work.
That flash of clarity became a plan to buy the school and turn it into a community center and a Christian private school. Keycaver, the village superintendent, hopes to send his own young kids there. For now, though, it's the focus of a bitter court battle between Mattoon and the Unified School District of Antigo, which owns the building, or which might own the building. Antigo agreed to sell the building to the village, but insisted on a restriction. Mattoon Elementary could not be used as a school. Reamer says they were worried parents would use the state's school voucher program to enroll in the new private school.
So I gave it some thought, prayed about it, and met with some people, and I decided, okay, we're going to move forward.
But as the sale was being finalized, Mattoon officials found that the Antigo School District didn't possess the deed for the school. That raised the question of whether the district could be the legal owner of the building. And if the building belongs to Mattoon, then the village can sell it to Reamer without any restrictions. Outside the village hall, Jeff Stieg, a member of the Mattoon Village Board, chatted with Reamer and Keycaver about Antigo's position.
How can you sell something they don't own? That'd be like you selling my neighbor's car that don't belong to you. You know, I mean, you can do that, can't you, Wade?
The president of the Antigo School Board declined to comment for this story, citing the pending court case. But Kim Kokel of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance said districts like Antigo are under real financial pressure. Antigo lost 7% of its enrollment over the last 5 years, and fewer students means fewer state dollars. Kokol says if Mattoon parents turned to the school voucher program, that could squeeze the district even more.
If I'm a Mattoon resident and I want to keep my kid in the Antigo school district, you know, I want to make sure all the resources from Mattoon are going to Antigo Public School and not elsewhere.
Mattoon Elementary School is one of more than 70 rural schools in Wisconsin that have closed since 2011. In some places, buildings have been converted into senior housing or technical education centers. In others, they're left to decay. Keycaver doesn't want to see that happen here.
I want to see this community succeed. I want to see the younger generation succeed. And quite frankly, right now, that worries me where that's going.
Reamer is represented in the suit by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. The Milwaukee-based group is an advocate for expanding school vouchers. Executive Vice President C.J. Safer says rural and small-town public schools now often lag far behind suburban and even urban schools.
The status quo for education in rural and small-town Wisconsin is just simply not sustainable, and it shouldn't be acceptable.
Outside the vacant building, Reamer says he believes one way or another they will open the school.
You have a building that's always been a school, still wants to be a school, it's paid for, why wouldn't it be a school?
The next step in the court fight is Friday. Reamer says it could be years before they know whether the school bells will return. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, imagine seeing hundreds of offensive and disturbing social media posts every day. Well, that's the reality for the tens of thousands of people whose job it is to intercept that material before it gets to us. We'll look at the role of social media moderators. And tomorrow is the anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We'll find out what its biggest successes have been, where it's fallen short, and how well it's aged in the 29 years it's been in place. That's tomorrow on Central Time.